Hi, this is Warren Olney. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast of To the Point, and I want to tell you about another podcast that's available here at KCRW, and that's the program DNA, hosted by Francis Anderton. Francis is well connected in the industry of design and architecture and art. She used to be editor of an architecture magazine. She knows the trends before they happen. She'll be able to fill you in on them. You can find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
When childcare costs as much as college. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In the last 20 years, the cost of childcare has outstripped every other line item in the family budget. Meanwhile, the quality of care is lower than any other developed nation in the world. Some parents crunch the numbers and decide it makes more sense to stay home. And despite the lean-in and feminist revolutions, the parent dropping out of the workforce is still usually a mom. Should the government subsidize childcare as aggressively as higher education? What should employers do to ease the work-life balance for both men and women? Also on today's Talking Point, a roundup of the tech stories we'll keep talking about into 2015. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
It's To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, as childcare costs overwhelm young families, more women are staying home, and families are losing financial ground. Has the time come for federally funded daycare? Should employers step up with paid leave, flexible work hours, on-site preschool? More on that later. And on today's Talking Point, the stories that we'll be talking about in tech into 2015. First to Russia, where a Moscow court today convicted the anti-corruption crusader and opposition leader Alexei Navalny of criminal fraud charges. The court suspended his sentence, but in a surprise move, ordered his brother, who was also charged, to serve 3.5 years. The case is widely seen as political retribution by President Putin on Navalny, a former postal worker turned activist. Mark Galeotti joins us now from Moscow. He's a security expert at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, and it's good to have you on the program.
My pleasure.
So I understand Navalny was detained again by police shortly after his court hearing, and the AP is reporting that currently police are breaking up the protests going on in Moscow. What happened there?
Well, this is a classic Russian response. Navalny called for these sort of protests and said that he was determined to go and be there. Well, what tends to happen, as in this case, is the police arrest him. They don't charge him. I mean, the last news we had is they were, quote unquote, escorting him home, basically just to get him out of the situation. So they put him in a cell or they send him home or whatever. But yes, it's quite interesting that we've also seen the riot police moving in really quite heavy-handedly against the protests today. Again, nothing that's unusual, but what is clear is that we in a situation where we might see a return to the kind of street protests that we saw in Moscow a couple of years back.
And remind us of Navalny's history as an activist and a corruption crusader. He led those street protests for months after the parliamentary elections in 2011.
Yeah, I mean, he's never been like the single leader of the opposition or whatever, but he's probably, he's certainly the most charismatic and he's probably the most politically long-lived so far. I mean, this is a man who very much has built his political campaign last years on the whole issue of corruption, on the extent to which the Russian elite embezzle and defraud on quite massive scales. And he's very much got under the skin of the Kremlin, because he's managed to get some excellent sources and made some exposés about, you know, the grand palaces in which people live. And so this is really why the Kremlin is so worried about him, because the danger is that if he manages to really reach out to Russians as a whole, the dislike of corruption is something that unites the Muscovite middle class and the Omsk tram driver. So there is the chance that he could really build some kind of broad-based political movement.
So how is the imprisoning of his brother, Oleg, and this move in the chess game between the Kremlin and Navalny viewed in Russia? Is this a ramping up of a policy of zero tolerance for political dissent, or is it just a new twist in the tactics?
Well, it's too soon to say how it's viewed in Russia yet, because if nothing else, remember, most of the media, certainly the TV media, is very much state-controlled. So there's not a lot of discussion taking place. It's going to take a while for the word to percolate out. But this is definitely a new phase in sort of Kremlin tactics, and a new and interestingly spiteful one. After all, they've tried leaning on Navalny in the past, and he's made it clear that he's not willing to be leaned on. He continued to speak out even while he was in house arrest. So clearly they've now decided to go after his brother, a man who, it has to be said, has had no real kind of political role up to this point, as essentially a hostage for Navalny's good behaviour. So it'll be interesting to see. Certainly the first indications are that Navalny is angry at this, and in fact it's making him more rather than less willing to take on the Kremlin.
And can you speak to the timing of this? Because today's verdict was supposed to have been announced next month, but the verdict was moved up just ahead of Russian New Year's and Orthodox Christmas, and of course in the midst of a larger context of what of Russia's moves in the Crimea and in Ukraine.
Yeah, there's two factors here. Clearly, on the one hand, the Kremlin was trying to wrong-foot the opposition because they'd already called for a protest and a rally on the day in which the sentence was meant to be handed down, the 15th of January. So I suppose there was an attempt to, we'll rush it out and then they won't have a chance to form any kind of protest. Well, as I said, in fact, we saw hundreds, indeed, possibly even a couple of thousand people still willing on an ad hoc basis to protest today. So that's part of it. But the second reason is that you're already beginning to feel the real bite of sanctions and low oil prices. I mean, although looking around Moscow supermarkets, you can still see pretty much all the goods that were always there, the prices are definitely up, far more than salaries are up. So I think there is a sense that every week you manage to sort of bring things forward, it's a week or so in which actually people have not yet had the chance to start thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on? Why is the ruble in my pocket buying that much less? So it's tactical, but it's also a concern that, in fact, things are going to get harder for the Kremlin, not easier.
Mark Galeotti, security expert at New York University's Center for Global Affairs. He joined us from Moscow. Thanks so much for this. I appreciate your taking the time.
Pleasure.
And when we come back, when childcare costs more than some colleges, has the time come for more family-friendly policies from Washington and Wall Street? A discussion of the high cost of childcare and where it leaves the feminist movement. That's coming up. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. In 2012, the cost of childcare in the U.S. grew up to 8 times faster than family income. That makes it by far the most expensive cost in families' budgets. And according to the latest Pew Research Center report on childcare, a growing number of parents are opting out of the workforce as a result. Now 30% of moms stay at home. Is the exploding expense of childcare setting back the clock on the women's movement? What role should employers play in supporting working families? Should the United States have federally mandated paid parental leave and more subsidies for childcare? And these are just some of the questions we'll ask on today's show. Joining us first, Danielle Kurzleben is the business and economics correspondent for Vox.com. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Let's start with just some quick numbers and stats. What's the average cost of childcare per child in the U.S.?
Sure. Of course, there's a lot of data sources. It depends on what you look at. But I can tell you one group, Child Care Aware, found that the average daycare cost, and this is full-time for an infant, so it can vary by child, was around $11,700 for a family. But, you know, the Census Bureau has a slightly lower estimate. They say it's around $148 weekly, which calculates out to about $8,000 annually. And that was as of 2011. But that is up pretty significantly, even when you adjust for inflation. That's up from $87 in 1985. That's not quite double. And that's just since 1985.
And of course, we here in Los Angeles find those numbers incredibly low.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, here in D.C., child care is fantastically expensive. Like I said, I'm based in Washington. And according to Child Care Aware numbers again, so these are the higher estimates, but Washington, D.C., it's around 21,000 was their last estimate I found. Boston, it can be up to 2,000 a year, I've read in some cities. And I don't know the Los Angeles numbers, but I imagine it's pretty high out there as well.
And just to put it in the context of other consumer costs, how does it compare to the cost of other services, say? Is it a pace with the rising of those costs, or is it completely on its own trajectory?
I mean, if you compare it to the entire consumer price index, I found in an article I did earlier this year, I started the inflation at around May 1994 and went through May 2014. Over those 20 years, the cost of childcare was around double. It rose at around double the rate of the consumer price index. It's fantastically high. I mean, that's the kind of cost growth. It may even be higher than the kind of cost growth we've seen in, you know, say, healthcare, which, of course, we all know is another troubling sector.
And it's a huge question why healthcare is growing so expensive so quickly. Why is childcare growing so expensive so quickly? When
right.
I can't, I personally, I don't see the change in the quality of that care.
Exactly. Well, and that's a great point. I mean, we can start there. This doesn't exactly explain why it's rising, but it's hard for childcare's cost to fall in the same way that, you know, the cost of, say, food service can fall or the cost of my computer can fall. You know, a lot of things costs have fallen because technological advancement allows them to fall. But, you know, you can't automate childcare. We don't have robot nannies, for example. So it's hard to really bring it down. There's a certain floor there. And aside from that, I mean, one thing that helps drive costs up in some places is regulation. I mean, of course, we need regulations on childcare. You want, you know, a good, safe place with enough teachers and aides for your kids. But, you know, for example, in Massachusetts, one source I read on that state, which has very high cost of childcare, also pointed out that, well, that state requires, I believe it was one adult to every three infants, which is on the higher end of that ratio for a lot of states. So that's one thing. Another thing, though, to add, though, is, you know, say a city like New York City. Think about how fast the rents are growing in a place like New York or in a lot of other cities. Child care centers have to pay rent. They have to pay for health insurance. They have to pay for all sorts of things. So that can really drive the costs up as well.
Well, those things are going up, but it doesn't seem to be a case of wages going up for child care workers.
Absolutely not. And that's another great point you bring up. Sorry to interrupt you, but this is another thing that makes it hard to bring that cost down. It's not that we're paying our child care workers fantastic sums of money. It's quite the opposite. Childcare workers are some of the lowest wage workers in the U.S. economy.
So just one more statistic to put this into perspective. I was saying
sure.
that more and more parents and usually moms are opting out because they can't afford the luxury of working while paying
mm-hmm.
for childcare. So
right.
who is opting out and what are the numbers on how this is affecting women in the workforce in the U.S.?
Sure, yeah. Well, and that is, you pointed to that Pew study, and that's one great example. As Pew showed earlier this year, you know, the cost of childcare is going up, and it's risen as a share of a family income. And that's sort of, several studies have shown that that's helped bring the labor force participation of mothers down. There's one fantastic chart that I put in an article that I did earlier this year. If you look at the U.S. versus France since the Great Recession, for example, it's a little bit apples and oranges. But one thing France has is very heavily subsidized childcare from the government. The U.S. doesn't have that. And what you see is France's labor force participation for women is starting to tick up. For the U.S., it's starting to fall off. And that's really troubling in an economy that is recovering.
Daniel Kortzleben is a business and economics correspondent for Vox.com. Arlie Hochschild is professor emeritus of sociology at UC Berkeley and author of The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. And it's such a pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
So we've just run through the numbers. You've said that the U.S. is in a stalled gender revolution. Is this what you're referring to, that women have changed their professional aspirations and have more career opportunities, but are still disproportionately responsible for caring for children and hamstrung by this lack of support for family-friendly policies?
Exactly. And that was the situation in the mid-80s when I wrote The Second Shift. But the question is it still the situation now? I think it is. I don't think we've gotten very far, that women have gone out into the labor force in great numbers, you know, moving from a third of workers to half. Big, big change, but the men they come home to and the jobs they go out to haven't changed as fast. Men have changed in that last 20 years a lot more than the workplace. And if you kind of look at the whole situation, it was interesting what Danielle was saying, that, overall, 70% of American children live in households where all the adults work. And for kids 6 and under, 65% live in households where all the adults work. That includes single mom families. So we really do need, you know, some way to unstall this revolution. We can't go back to yesteryear where there was local community to help and grandma was next door, and we can't, it seems, envision some of the solutions of European states across the pond, you know, so we're kind of stuck. And I think it is time to really take this issue up again.
Well, how important to get unstuck is it to put this in a broader context? And is that context our cultural values or national values? And what you bring up in a lot of your writing is that this issue of childcare exists in a broader context of how we outsource care, not just for children, but also older people, for the sick, also how we outsource just our personal responsibilities, like cleaning and applying, helping your children apply to college or any onerous activity that we do find personal assistance for if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it. That this is a problem of national, of values and where we place them.
Yes, I think so. But one of the values Americans have is having work. So the question is, how do we do that? How do we do that humanely? And I think if we look again at examples like Norway with its 35-hour work week and its 13 months of parental support shared with mom and dad, there are some amazing solutions. And if we look at the studies, I mean, our value on the welfare of children, I think, should be front and central. There's a very important comparative study that was done by UNICEF called the Report Card 7. And it compared the U.S. to 21 of the most affluent other societies, and what they found is we didn't do very well. We were in the bottom third for, five of the six different dimensions that were studied. Our kids are more likely to not have breakfast in the morning, not get fruit every day, not have good relations with classmates, not have someone to talk to, more likely to get fat and smoke pot. So I think if our values have to be put the welfare of children together with the importance of work, and I think other societies have done better at this than we have, and it's time for us to get a clue, you know?
Well, what are employers doing to help workers achieve a better work-life balance and to support families with children?
You know, it's
in the U.S.
You get two totally different stories. If you ask employers, you get a finding like this, that some 41% allow some employees to have flex time, and you have over third, 38% say that they can work at home, so telecommuting, and over half say they pay maternal leave. So that's what employers say. But if you look at what employees say, how much are they likely to participate in, quote, employer-provided benefit plans, the figures are much lower. It's just 12% of private sector workers say they had access to paid family leave, maternal or paternal. 10% of private sector workers say they have access to financial help with the cost of child care. So you get two pictures. And I think the findings that we get from the employees, that I think that's the figure to look at, and that probably when you look at the kinds of works men and women do, women often work for smaller companies that don't have these benefits. And so, and when benefits are offered, it's generally to professional and managerial workers, and so, not to blue-collar workers. So in general, private sector workers are not getting support.
And so the discrepancy in those numbers, you put it down to the distribution of these benefits, but also perhaps to this cultural bias. Again, there is a bias still exist against workers taking advantage of any of these offerings when they are offered?
Yes, well, that's true, too. That's true, too. And again, I think other cultures do a lot better than we do. For example, paternity leave, South Korea and Singapore have, one has 1 week paid paternity leave for all workers. Another has 2 weeks. We don't have anything like that.
Now, you were mentioning earlier the effects of poor quality daycare. Are there also persuasive science on and studies on the benefits, the beneficial effects of parental leave on families and of good on-site daycare, something that would contribute to the bottom line for employers to step up their support of families with children?
That is, I think you've just kind of put in a capsule the basic question. Yes, we have a lot of information indicating that these policies are good for parents and they're good for kids. And if you look in the United States, for example, Head Start has lasting effects on the kids that benefit from going there. So irrefutable evidence that works. And, you know, if you look, for example, at, again, Norway, that they both have a higher proportion of women in the labor force and much higher indices of kids thriving. You know, so how do they – I think we have to have a look. How can you do that? It can be done.
And you also cited some interesting figures on the effect of parental leave when fathers take parental leave, the effect it has on their kids.
Yes, it's amazing that actually father care in a child's younger years is shown to have effects when the kid's in college.
So lasting effects.
Lasting effects.
Well, we're going to go to the break now, and then we're going to continue this conversation about the high cost of childcare, what we can do about it, the effect it's having on families, and the movement for gender equality. And later on our talking point, will you boycott Uber this New Year's Eve? We look ahead to what will likely be big in tech news in 2015. And that's all on To The Point. Stay with us from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back with To The Point, I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the high cost of childcare in the U.S., how it affects both women and men in the workplace and at home, and what it would take both to make childcare more affordable for families and also of better quality. Joining us now, Tamara Strauss, editorial director of the Blum Center for Developing Economies at UC Berkeley. Welcome to The Point.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to hear your story. It's so compelling. Tell us what happened when you were pregnant and in your ninth month.
Sure. But I just want to back up and say I wrote an essay in California Magazine telling this personal story because the editor of that magazine, Wendy Miller, really felt that when it came to the women's movement and the way that people, Americans now think about feminism of all ages, it's deeply personal. So she asked me to write a personal reported essay. And I wrote about how when I was in my ninth month, I was fired from my job. Magazine job, my boss was Francis Ford Coppola. The magazine was very successful. My husband was finishing his PhD. So I was the main breadwinner. And I also held health insurance. And I had to fight to have my health insurance expanded, and it wasn't really the way I intended to spend my last month of pregnancy or my last few weeks. And it really made me think about how far the women's movement has come, and as Arlie Hochschild puts it, what is stalled. And I was eager because of our precarious work situation. My husband was on the academic job market, of the difficulty of finding childcare and the expense of childcare. And so I've been thinking about these issues for about 10 years.
And just backing up for a moment, when you lost your job, were the circumstances related to you being pregnant and about to take leave, or the fear that you would not come back, or in any way related to your having a child?
You know, the circumstances were that I was trying to get raises for my two employees. It was a magazine job, so it wasn't particularly well paid. And, you know, I was basically told that, you know, I was basically told to leave. And, you know, it was, I got a settlement. If it had gone to court of law, I think I would have, you know, won a much bigger sum. But so it's extremely upsetting, and but I managed to find work a couple months later as an editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I've been gainfully employed since. So I consider myself pretty lucky, considering I had that bumpy start into working motherhood.
And that start, I would imagine, would haunt anybody. It must have haunted you. How did you end up managing to pursue a career and kids and personally work out this work-life balance?
You know, I don't think my situation is terribly unusual. I mean, maybe the circumstances of losing my job when I was that far along in my pregnancy. I had set up daycare. I had a full plan about how I was to come back after 3 months. But, you know, I just, especially a generation ago, you know, women were fired for being pregnant. Fortunately, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, there were many laws passed that protected women in the workplace. And, you know, what I see in terms of this so-called stalled gender revolution is that the passage of laws that protect women and fathers and parents has really lost steam. One of the things that I've noted during my 10 years of parenthood, at least, is that parents tend to talk about choices. They talk about, you know, whether women stay, you know, whether the mother or in some cases the father chooses to stay home. They talk about the high cost of childcare and parenting. But I would say that the conversation is highly depoliticized. You know, in many circles, in mainstream media, we don't talk about what can be done. I love the example of Norway that Arlie Hochschild raises. However, Norway has a population of 5 million people. And I think that we are very far from implementing those kinds of family-friendly policies. But I do think, as I pointed out in my essay in California Magazine, that it is entirely possible for a rich country like ours, even with our and fragmented Congress, to figure out a way to subsidize child care, particularly for low and income people.
Well, who is moving forward on this? And I know you've written about the group Moms Rising, trying to bring about policy changes.
Moms Rising, I think, has done a really good job building a coalition of parents who are trying to get behind this kind of family-friendly legislation. And they're looking at it state by state. They look at it in a national perspective. I don't think I don't know how well known they are outside of circles of people who really care about this issue, but they are tracking it, and they do put pressure on senators, and they have been effective. You can go to their website, Moms Rising, I think it's .org, and see their various petitions and information.
Tamara Strauss is editorial director of the Blum Center for Developing Economies at UC Berkeley. Let's get an overseas perspective. Emmy McCarthy is director of Amsterdam Mamas, a nonprofit organization providing information and support for international families living in the Netherlands. Thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So what percentage of a family's income in the Netherlands goes towards child care? I'm curious.
It varies greatly depending on the income, because we have a sliding scale of subsidization from the government from daycare, which means that a family could receive over 90% of their childcare costs back if they're a low-income family, where at the higher end you'd be 18% maybe of your childcare costs back. So it does vary depending on your income bracket.
But 18 to 90, wow, that's a really broad range.
A very broad range.
And what kinds of policies in the workplace are in place to support both traditional families and single mothers?
They're very good policies. The flexible working is available, and many employers, particularly in the government and academia, will employ those types of family-friendly policies. It's extremely usual here for one or both parents to have a day off during the week, which is their parental day. We call them mother day and father days. So children may do 3 days of daycare, one day with a mother, one day with a father, or a day with another family member.
How lovely. I think I'm tearing up, actually, just thinking about that. And do men or women in the Netherlands suffer any stigma if they take that kind of, create that kind of schedule for themselves, or if they take family leave or cut down their hours?
No, it's actively encouraged. In fact, there was a study done by the University of Utrecht a few years ago where they talked to the population about how they perceived women in the workplace, and found that women who work part-time were received very well. Women who didn't work or who chose to work full-time were perceived as lower or not of as great value.
And paid parental leave, what is the a common amount and amount of time?
Legally, a mother-to-be has to stop working by the 36th week of her pregnancy, and she'll have 16 weeks of paid leave.
Now, before we get too depressed here, just to put a finer point on it, what kind of care do small children in the Netherlands, say, get in the subsidized state creches? Is it considered high quality? And what's the standard?
The standard is very high. It's government regulated. All daycares are inspected by government inspectors from the Ministry of Health. Those results are published both on the daycare's website and also on a national registry database, so that when you're researching where to send your child, you're able to look into the database and compare different care providers. We also have a much more flexible system of daycare. So we also have the traditional daycare options, as well as childminder options, which are nannies who look after them in their own houses. And nannies who are registered in your house will also receive a subsidy back.
Emmy McCarthy, she's with Amsterdam Mamas, a nonprofit organization supporting families in the Netherlands. Danielle Kortzleben, business and economics correspondent for Vox.com. Can you put that data in the context of what we have here in America? What would it take for us to even start to catch up?
It would take a sea change. I mean, is the short answer. One concrete example I can give you is one of the biggest and best known ways that we subsidize childcare in the U.S., which is the child care tax credit. That, you know, it's in the tax code. A lot of us know about it, but really, there are a lot of problems with it. I mean, so this one big tax credit that we offer really isn't that big, and a lot of people don't get it. One of my colleagues here at Vox.com, Dylan Matthews, wrote about this earlier this year. He found that only 4.5% of individuals or couples paying taxes even claimed that last year. 4.5%. I mean, that's a tiny fraction. It costs the government very little, and because of the way the tax code is set up, and I can get into the nitty-gritty of this if you want to, but really, it's set up in this very funny way where it actually ends up benefiting middle to upper class families and not really so much the lower class families have intended to benefit. So we have a very messy system that could be optimized in so many ways, even before we begin to approach how Europe does this sort of thing.
Danielle Kortzleben with Vox.com. Tamara Strauss with the Blum Center for Developing Economies at UC Berkeley. Where is the political will? We should say that the flip side of the question of political will to move forward to support families is that people make the argument who don't have children, why should the government support families? It was their choice to have the huge expensive packages known as children, and why subsidize their lifestyle choices when childless people are left to fend on their own?
Well, most people choose to have families still. That's the only way I could answer that second question. But in terms of the political will, I think that's a tough one. I would think it could come from voters. And I think that the issue of childcare and generally of, you know, re-subsidizing public education could be a big issue for voters of all ages. I think that if we, you know, it depends on how it's framed. And politicians aren't able, it seems, to frame this question of, you know, more societal benefits, whether it's in terms of child care, elder care, education, health care, as successfully as they could, you know, a generation ago. We have a very divisive and fragmented political landscape. But some people have tried to make the issue of parenting primary. I don't think, some politicians that is, I don't think with huge success, unfortunately.
Tamara Strauss with UC Berkeley. Arlie Hochschild, author of The Second Shift, how is the growing economic disparity, the income gap, contributing to the challenge of easing some of the stress on families and also building the political will to change this?
It's making it a lot harder for the tiny 1%. Yes, there are more choices about work-family balance, but for the bottom, fewer choices, many more single moms. And people in the middle are more anxious about keeping the jobs they've got and about improving their salaries. So I think the growing gap between the rich and the poor is bad for families. And I'd add that in a way we've got a kind of a prevailing ideology in the political landscape these days of family values going with free market policies. Free market policies involving deregulation, service cuts, minimal government. Actually, if you look at what the data we have says, is that the value of children, if we think of valuing all children, really goes with forms of effective government support. So I think looking ahead, we need to get people to re-examine that political package.
So, and what are the top priorities? Federal standards for childcare, or federally mandated longer paid parental leave, or hitting workplaces more in a more focused way? I mean, what's the path?
All of those, I think, are the path. We have to realize that actually, to my knowledge, there are no federal standards for childcare today, and that study done by Ellen Galinsky on the quality of childcare in America is that it's extremely low, except for, you know, the top 10%. So, I mean, let's just start there. We really need to pull up our socks and make this really, you know, something that's great for kids. It's not some sad tragedy, but it's really great for kids. And I think the family-friendly policies that we've talked about for the last 30 years are still not implemented. And when they are implemented, it's only for professional and managerial workers. We need to, you ask what to do, make those policies of flex time, flex place, part-time work, and make that available to blue-collar workers, to most workers.
Arlie Hochschild, with the second author of The Second Shift. Tamar Strauss with UC Berkeley, putting this in the context of growing economic income disparity. Do you agree with Arlie Hochschild's prescriptions, and what pathway do you see to a more political will behind these family-friendly policies?
I do. I mean, I think one of the data points that not many Americans know is, it was mentioned earlier in the program, but that 40% of first-time mothers are unmarried, and more than half split from their mate by the time their child is five. That's from a Pew Research study from a few months ago. So we're looking at a population of increasing numbers of single mothers, and as we know from years of research, single mothers are, you know, stressed in numerous ways. Their children often don't have the benefits of extended families or two-parent families. And so just in terms of looking at the kind of demographic issues, we really do need to come up with a means for subsidizing low and to some extent mid-income families so that we can have an even playing field for more Americans. It's the means to strengthen our democracy. And so we have this, you know, social and cultural choice about where to put our taxpayer dollars. And child care is, I think, you know, one of the most obvious places. I would so like to see it become a big political issue.
Tamar Strauss, editorial director of the Blum Center for Developing Economies at UC Berkeley. Arlie Hochschild, author of The Second Shift. Danielle Kortzleben, business and economics correspondent for Vox.com. And Emmy McCarthy joined us from Amsterdam. Mamas, thanks to all of you. Very much appreciate you taking the time to talk about this on today's show. In a moment, net neutrality, the sharing economy, and the new smartphone hotness. A look ahead to the tech stories that will dominate the news in 2015. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogame, in for Warren Olney with today's talking point. 2014 was a banner year for new technology and controversies over its ramifications. Think net neutrality, the sharing economy, and all those people wearing Google Glass bumping into things. None of this is going away anytime soon. So in the spirit of the new year, we're looking ahead to some ongoing tech stories for 2015. Wahini Vara is a business and technology correspondent for NewYorker.com, and you can find her roundup of tech headlines for 2015 on the site today. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me.
Well, I'd like to start with Uber. You started with Uber. And I personally, for me, it's been a wild ride with Uber. First, I thought it wasn't safe. I wouldn't let anyone in my family use it. And then I became a complete Uber addict after visiting San Francisco. And now Uber is the face of the exploitative aspect of the sharing economy and kind of the tech brats of today. I just don't know what to think.
Yeah, no, it's I sometimes don't either, and I have to admit to you, even though I'm a tech writer and shouldn't admit this to you, that I'm a relative newcomer to Uber myself. So by the time I started using Uber, I have a car, so I often don't need to use services like that. But by the time I started using Uber, the company was sort of like already in trouble earlier this year. And what has struck me is that, you know, there's just, like, there's bad news after bad news for this company. People are describing Uber as a sort of, like, poster child for the kind of dark side of Silicon Valley. And at the same time, you know, we've seen this before with companies like Amazon, where people are upset with the company because it sort of bumps up against our notions of what good corporate behavior is, and it bumps up against our traditional ways of doing things. And then, like, these services are so easy to use that we just use them anyway, you know?
Well, that's the thing. And it's not just Uber, really. We're talking about this idea of the sharing economy, which is so enticing, so easy to use, as you say, but so exploitative of its workers.
Right, right. So that's the thing. And in some ways, this is the story of business for, you know, millennia. These companies are very consumer oriented. I mentioned Amazon. Amazon, you know, for more than a decade has been very focused on the consumer. Uber, similarly, or Airbnb, are very focused on their users, and they're committed to building these services that people are going to like. Sometimes what that means is that you're building a service that perhaps isn't as fair to, you know, the people providing the service. And the reason that's the case for these companies that describe themselves as members of the sharing economy is that rather than having employees provide these services, and employees would have sort of some modicum of labor protections, they have contractors technically providing these services. And so, you know, they're
right. Institutionalizing poverty. So what will we see in 2015? A raft of new lawsuits over Airbnb and Uber? More regulation? More Uber going south?
I think more regulation, more lawsuits are quite likely. Now, it's hard to know what's going to happen, but I can't see this trajectory sort of stopping now. I think there are a lot of questions that have been raised that have yet to play out. And a lot of the lawsuits, by the way, against Uber and others that have been introduced this year are still going to be playing out in the courts next year. So even if nothing new comes up, you know, all of this stuff will be playing out next year, certainly.
Well, moving on, you placed Alibaba third on your list of big tech stories looming in 2015, and that's the Chinese online mega retailer like Amazon.com on steroids. Why is it so significant, besides the obvious fact that it recently went public in the U.S. for the first time in just a huge IPO?
For me, the significance has partly to do with sort of U.S. perception or U.S. awareness of what Alibaba is. Of course, as you point out, Alibaba has existed for many years. It's been really successful in China for many years and elsewhere. But people in the U.S. haven't really been aware of it. One thing that struck me when Alibaba went public is that Ipsos did a poll for Reuters that found that 88% of Americans had never heard of Alibaba, and this was about a week before the IPO. And so it was one of the biggest tech stories, or really business stories, of the year. It was a huge IPO, a historically huge IPO, a record-sized IPO, and yet, like, almost 9 out of 10 people have never heard of this company in the U.S. among Americans. And so it sort of speaks to this change, I think, that's taking place in the business world and in the tech world in particular, in which, you know, it's perhaps no longer fair to assume that all of the interesting new developments are going to come out of the U.S. And maybe in the next year and in coming years, we'll see more awareness among Americans and among people in the U.S. Of what's happening outside of our borders, because a lot of the interesting stuff is happening there.
Okay, I buy that. You brought me around. But I'm not with you on Apple's smartwatch. I just...
You're,
I just don't see, make the case. Why in 2015 will we hear so much and care so much about Apple Smartwash?
Well, because it's, the short answer is because it's Apple, which I'm sure is the answer you expected to hear from me. Apple is often not the first to release big new gadgets, but it often does come up with the definitive version. So, you know, other companies built PCs before Apple. Other companies built MP3 players. In fact, in the late 90s, I owned an MP3 player by another company, and it did not particularly excite me. And then Apple comes around and does these things, and by virtue of being Apple and having the cachet of being Apple, and then also by virtue, of course, of having this incredible design team internally, Apple comes out with these products that people pay attention to. And I think the reason people are intrigued by the smartwatch, without knowing much about it, Apple showed some prototypes but hasn't said too much, is that we've seen that Apple has a track record of putting out these products that people like. A lot of people share your skepticism, and I think that's because it's still hard to understand. Like, Apple hasn't totally made the case, and no one has really made the case that smartwatches are all that necessary. You know, Apple's got these fun little, like, Apple's watch has all these sort of fun little tricks that it does, like monitoring your heartbeat and showing you this cute picture of a beating heart, or the beating heart of the person you're talking to on. You know,
I would much rather have a shoe phone. I've been waiting for that since Get Smart. Just scrap. Millennials don't even wear watches, so I don't know. Maybe they'll bring it back, Apple,
right,
for millennials. But just in the last 30 seconds or so, Facebook grabbed up Oculus Rift, the virtual reality headgear, and now Mark Zuckerberg says he has big plans for it on Facebook. So
right.
Is this all 2015 all going to be about the backlash on Facebook against the marketing of virtual reality?
Yeah, well, right. Speaking of crazy new technologies, this sort of beats the smartwatch in my view. It's like, it's this giant thing that you strap onto your face, and, you know, so Oculus has been doing this, has been focused in the past on video gaming, but Mark Zuckerberg has this vision of people using a device like this to, like, you know, talk to their grandparents on, you know, have the grandkids talk to the grandparents on Skype.
And I'm sure we're going to hear so much about it, and really what we need are contact lenses, and probably it'll be outmoded
right
by the time he rolls it out on Facebook.
That's
Wahine Vara, business and technology correspondent for NewYorker.com, thanks so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Alney. He'll be back with you tomorrow. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.